Today is November 20th, and we are in our second class on Mashiach, the messianic study from the origins of the idea to the our hopes and aspirations for the messianic age and the messianic personality. So we're going to see what the discuss today the decision that appears in pretty early on in the Bible for which tribe should produce the messianic line. So we all know the answer now. Good. So what's the point of even discussing what went along the way? So we know the answer is Yehuda. That's why we're called Jews, right? We're Yehudim. We're only named after one of the 12 tribes. If we would be more inclusive, we should be called Israelites. So we'll see when did we start to be called Jews? Why are we called Jews? There are different names for us in biblical history. We were called Hebrews at some point, right? So we'd like to trace some of this. This history. Obviously, it doesn't make sense to call us Israelites before there's an Israel. So, we were Avraham is called the Avram HaIvri, either because he was descended from a man named Aver. Aver was a direct line between Noach and Avraham. That's probably the Hebrew language, the ancient Hebrew alphabet language. Is probably comes from that designation as Aver, or possibly also, as some say, that Avraham crossed over the from Mesopotamia into Israel, into Canaan. So he had to cross over possibly the Yarden, but more likely the Tigris and Euphrates, and he had to cross over from Aram Naharaim and Nahor and Haran and all these different places and Ur Kasdim. So to get to the new place where God wanted him to set up a new system. And historically, the center of ancient commerce moved, just as Avraham did, from Mesopotamia to Canaan. I mean, when Avraham went to Canaan, it was not a very safe and friendly place. It was a war zone, as we know from Bereishit chapter 14, and a famine zone, certainly from chapter 12 and 13. So Avraham didn't question, he said, God, this is not the best time to be coming to Canaan from Mesopotamia, right? So nonetheless, he goes and he changes history. So he is called, of course, we refer to him as Avraham HaIvri. And I would tell you that in biblical reference, as well as in extra biblical reference, Hebrews is a pejorative. The Philistines use it that way. The Egyptians use it that way. Okay, it's sort of like I think to refer to Jews today as Hebrews or Heb might be some kind of pejorative. So I would tell you also, since we're in this introductory phase, there is an ancient civilization known as the Habiru. Some say Hapiru. Mm-hmm. The P and the B interchange quite a bit. They're both coming from the same place of your mouth. And there are some societies that don't even have the P sound. They can't say P. You try to tell them. Right, they don't. Annapolis became Nablus. So the Hapiru and Habiru, whether it's the same, because there is a Hapiru nation that was slaves in Egypt and threw off the yoke of the slavery. So, okay, happy day. We have a historical reference to Yetzias Mitzrayim. I don't know if that's such a happy day. First of all, we believe in Yetzias Mitzrayim not because of archaeology, but because of our faith. And second of all, the Habiru were not a... not well liked in the ancient world. They were fierce, and maybe we had to be in order to leave Egypt. But be it as it may, so we have these various designations, and Yaakov has his name changed to Yisrael, And we don't appear to be a nation yet until Paro makes us a nation. He said, "Hein am b'nei Yisrael rav v'atzum mimenu." The nation of Israel is more mighty than we are. So we become from a family to a people in slavery in Egypt. And the place to start for today's shir, which is again to determine which tribe gets the zchut of being the savior tribe. So,
what language did Abraham speak?
So before he comes to Canaan, I imagine he's speaking Aramaic. He comes from Aram Naharaim. Mm-hmm. Aramaic is close enough to Hebrew. It's both Semitic languages. But most likely that he spoke Aramaic. When Yaakov was at Laban's house, I'm sure they spoke Aramaic. Mm-hmm. Right. So
is that what they spoke in Babylon?
Oh, yes. Aramaic. There's no Babylonian language. Babylon is Aramaic. The Talmud, it's Babylonian Talmud, is in Aramaic. So... So the place to look for which tribe gets this privilege. So we're going to look at the end of the book of Bereishis, in chapter 49. Okay. So the nation. 127. The nation is named after one of our third patriarch. His name starts off as Jacob and it's changed to Israel. And the first patriarch, Abraham, Avram, his name is also changed to Avraham. God changing a name is indicative of a nefesh asher asu b'charon. You know, Yosef's name is changed by Paro.
I will make Yehoshua, the name great.
Yehoshua's name is changed by Moshe. People change names. It's an indication that you should be happy with. I am sort of creating you or giving you a new identity. So Yitzchak's name doesn't have to be changed because, unlike Avraham and Yaakov, God named Yitzchak himself. Of course, I named you to begin with. I don't have to change your name. So when Yisrael, I take my father to see today. I'll take it right now. Excuse me. Second. Okay. Thanks. So of Yaakov's children, it would make sense that through our, especially since we are a firstborn-centric kind of nation, we're going to have a law in the Torah that the firstborn gets the double portion. So Reuven should probably be the one who produces the king. But as you all know from other courses and over time we've had so much opportunity to talk about Reuven and his nature. He's not worthy of the kingship because he is unstable, right? And I think last time we looked at Pasuk in Divrei Hayamim that actually said Reuven is the Bechor, but he lost the Bechorah to Yosef, and Yosef does seem to get some aspect of the Bechorah because he gets two tribes, right? So Yosef is gets Ephraim and Menashe, which is, his father says, is a Shechem Echad Alachecha. Probably means a portion over your brother, with a pun on the name of the city where he was supposed to make up with them. Go to Shechem to see the peace of your brothers, but he never made it there because they sold him. And they moved on from there and they went to a different place. So they all get back to Shechem where Yosef is buried. So Yosef gets the double portion, but then it says afterwards, but not to become king because the kingship went to Yehuda. So then it's our job here to discuss what did Yehuda do to deserve that Yaakov on his deathbed recognizes that. And let's just see the verses now. It's verse 8. Yehuda ato yoducha. See? Pasuk chet. Yehuda ato yoducha achecha yodcha ba'orif oivecha. So he speaks about how important it is that he is able to protect the nation from the enemy. The first thing you expect from your king is security. Right? If you don't have security, everything else falls away. Right? And Bnei Yisrael say that we want a king is because we're the threat from the Philistines. We're tired of this Sefer Shoftim cycle where every time the leader dies, we're at the mercy of another nation. We want to have a king who can take care of our security needs. That's the first thing you want. And that's the first thing that Shaul does. Right? He saves the people from losing their right eye. Remember that story in Yavesh Gilad? By cutting up an animal into 12 pieces and sending one to each tribe. And this is what I'm going to do to all your farm animals if you don't come in good numbers to defend the people of Yavesh Gilad. Right? Stama, that's where he was from. Right? Because the end of Sefer Shoftim, like the polar opposite story. But there's a terrible story. A woman is cut up into 12 pieces and sent to each tribe to show how fractious the nation had become. And the people, which tribe was almost lost then, was Binyamin. And Shaul, the first king, is from that tribe. So the tribe was almost wiped out when the men killed everyone but 400 men and swore not to give their daughters over to these men. So who are these men going to marry? So they took women from a place called Yavesh Gilad. And so Shaul from Shevet Binyamin must have been descended from these people. So he defended his ancestors, so to say. Especially according to the commentaries like Radak, who say that story happened at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. It's 400 years before. More. Be that as it may, the Shaul as king unites the people. The question is there any hint at Yaakov's deathbed? He makes it very clear that Yehuda is the king. He says it very clear by saying first, Yoducha Achacha. Your brothers admit that you're the leader. It's the first thing you have to have, right? And it says, it speaks of his might, good, that's the security we want. And he says in verse 10, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda mechokek mi ben raglav. The shevet, we're not up to that yet, quite good, but Yehuda will have the shevet and the mechokek. Shevet means the scepter or the reigning rod or the rule making the law making role. So there's nothing in Binyamin's bracha here that indicates that a king should come from him. However, there is something. I'll tell you the two things that make put Binyamin up there. Reuven is out, right? And Yosef is out.
Why is Yosef
out? We don't know yet. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. But he is. It says in Divrei Hayamim that he got the Bechorah, but not the Melucha. Uh-huh. He got the firstborn right, but not the kingship. Mm-hmm. I'll get to that shortly. And
he got the king, and he can't reconcile with his brothers.
Yeah.
He'll have to be able to lead everybody.
Yeah. We'll see that. Okay. So what does Binyamin have is that when before Binyamin was born...
He wasn't involved with the sale.
Right, he wasn't involved with the two things that Binyamin wasn't involved with. He wasn't involved with the sale of Yosef. He's the only son not involved with the sale of Yosef. And I'm putting Yosef as responsible for the sale of Yosef to some extent.
Okay.
But there's also another very crucial point that he wasn't involved with. That Chazal connect more to the Purim story, but also to kingship, is that everybody in Israel bows to Haman except Mordechai. So what's the midah keneged midah? Is that so Binyamin was the only one not born yet. Now if he was born, probably he would have bowed too, but it doesn't matter. He's the only one who didn't bow to Haman's ancestor, who's named. Haman is Agogi, the king of Amalek. Amalek is the grandson of Esav. Right? So when Yaakov met up with Esav after more than 20 years of absence, where he thought that his brother still harbored that murderous intent, right? So when Yaakov comes to see him, he bows flagrantly. I mean, he bows seven times. He keeps bowing and bowing. Tried to convince him, obviously, that the bracha never came true. That I took from you. I don't know if you know the contents of the bracha that Daddy gave me, but here I am bowing to you, right? I don't know if Yosef had, if Yosef had the pasuk, you know, did he have the actual blessing in front of him? But Yaakov seems to be trying to show him, line by line, that everything in that bracha never came true yet for me, right? You're the one with Talash Mayim Shmane Aretz. You're the one with Rav Dugan Vesirosh. You're the one who's Avi Avducha Mim Mishtachavu Lecha Mim Hevei Gvira Lecha Cheshtu Mimarecha. Right? You're the one. Everything in the bracha I took from you is coming true for you. Not for me. If it was coming true for me, you'd be bowing to me. So Yaakov bows in, and he puts all the children, all his wives, one by one, they're all bowing to Esav. Except?
Dina.
Binyamin. Oh, except Dina, yes. Sorry, but I'm sorry to say she's not in the running for being king. But Binyamin is the only one who doesn't bow to Esav. So Binyamin gets to produce this king, first king, who will not bow to the Philistines. He's not going to bow to the Arameans. He's not going to bow to the Ammonites who are threatening them. He wasn't born yet.
He wasn't born.
That's right.
He was born after.
Now I get it that, you know, if you weren't there, you know, why do you get reward? But okay, it's you know. Remember all the letters that come before God that say, start the Torah with me. And then God gets up to Bez, and Bez says, you know what? You don't have to start the Torah with me. I just want to be a blessing. I want to be a bracha. And God says, that's the first one that finally got it right. So then God looks at the Aleph, who never had a chance to say anything, right? And says, sorry, Aleph, right? But Bez stole the show. But I'll tell you what, as a consolation prize, I'll let you start... Aseret HaDibrot. Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hetzeiti Chametz Mitzrayim. I'll let you start the Decalogue. All right? I'll let you be the first letter on all those tablets and the shoals all over the world. All right? All right, so but you get it. It's sort of similar to that. You know, why should he be rewarded for not bowing? He wasn't there, right? Okay, but he still didn't bow. That's a fact. All the others bowed, he didn't.
He couldn't.
Okay? So, but what's interesting is that In addition, there is the Binyamin's blessing, right? If you turn to it, Binyamin is towards the end. Turn the page, one page. Starts the sixth aliyah, you see it? Verse 27, 26, okay. Okay, so Yaakov refers to Binyamin's great prowess of protecting the people. He's like a wolf, and as anthropologists say, is that the way we were able to survive the lions and tigers and all those much larger animals that were wiping us out is by training the wolf, training 20, 30 wolves to protect us. And then we turn them into dogs, and then they're not able to protect themselves. But the Binyamin is the wolf who's able to protect. That's what I'm saying here. Now, in Devarim's reference to Binyamin's bracha, when Moshe blesses Binyamin, it's on page 510. Okay. Moshe makes no reference, page 510, 511. Moshe makes no reference of Yehuda serving as king, no overt reference. But he does make a reference in Binyamin's bracha, verse 12. It says, Yedid Hashem Yishkon Lavetach Alav. He's the beloved of God. And it mentions the word Yishkon, right, means that. As if to say that God resides in him. Or that whoever loves Hashem resides in security, levetach, securely with him, right? That's what you want from your king. That when Bnei Yisrael demanded a king from Shmuel, they said, we need a king, right? We don't want to have this continuous problems, I can say, for Shoftim, right? Okay. Then the pasuk concerns Chofef alav kol hayom uvein ksefav shochein. Right? So Chofef here means that God is always close to Binyamin's area, right? He hovers above Binyamin and resides between the shoulders of Binyamin. What are the shoulders of Binyamin? There's nothing that we don't have any pictures of this or paintings of this, but we have a sense based on Roman quarrying of Harabias that if you looked from what Avraham looked at from afar coming up from Hebron, we can probably guess where that was. It's the place called the Tayelet today. You ever see it?
Yes.
In, because we haven't been there in so long, Lisa, but you know, the Tayelet on the way up from, like, near...
It wasn't safe lately.
No. It's near Derech Beit Lechem and Derech Hebron, you know, near where the Olive Stones live there, yeah. You know, there. It's in the south of, the southern end of Yerushalayim. And when you're coming up, it's supposed to be one of the most beautiful views in the world. It's a panoramic view of all Yerushalayim, and you can see that it's like it's a mountain on a city on a hill. And the reason why the Har Habayis, which in Tanakh seems to be higher than everything around it, but if you stand on the Temple Mount, you're looking up at Hebrew University and Mount Olives, aren't you? It's higher than you. Right? Even if you're at the top of the steps, where you go up this, you know, to the old city, and you go further up, it seems that the Har Hazesim is higher than you, because the Romans quarried, significantly quarried Har Habayis, because they said, this temple, you know, we want our places to be higher. You know, the pantheon, they made their temples. Everyone made their temples on mountains, right? For obvious reasons, you want it to be the highest things. Everyone wants to look up to it, right? But if you looked at what Avraham was looking at when God told him, take your son up to this mountain, would probably look like a head between two shoulders. Har Hazesim being the right shoulder, and what's now, the top of the old city that goes into, you know, Chov Yafo and the Mamila Mall, you know, you all know what I'm talking about, right? So this would look like a head and two shoulders.
Over and above.
Right, so the head is the Har Habayis in the middle, and of course that's the land of Binyamin. So Binyamin is the God resides between the two shoulders of Binyamin, Har Habayis in the middle. Okay, the Temple Mount. So why does Moshe think that Binyamin deserves God's Shechina more than the other tribes? So that's what we said before. Because he was not responsible for the sale of Yosef. So why not Yosef? He was also not responsible for the sale of Yosef. The answer is he was, to some extent. But so the temples that stood in between our entry into the land of Israel and the Jerusalem, right, were always in the land of Yosef. The main one, of course, being Shiloh and Mount Ephraim. So Shiloh, you can visit now. It's a huge, huge tourist attraction now. We went there on our last trip. Remember, we took Moshe's kids there. Great children's activities there now. It's not to be missed. And they take you to the... great archaeological work being done there. So anyway, the Shiloh temple stood almost 400 years. It's not an insignificant amount of time. Right? The temple in Jerusalem did only stood 410 years the first time and 420 years the second time. Somewhat longer than that, but okay. Anyway, so Binyamin gets to be the king and gets to have the temple built in its place. And Shaul is this perfect specimen of humanity at first. We introduced him as such a humble and really a man who's uniting the nation, but then something goes wrong. The Talmud says he was too perfect. Mashiach can't be too perfect. If Mashiach is too perfect, he will not understand the people. Remember what the Talmud says. Mashiach has to have a kupa shel shrotzim. He has to have like a... today we might call either bones in this closet or skeletons and, you know, a can of worms. You ever hear of that? You know, hanging from his neck or something like that. You ever hear of this? Right, because Shaul is so perfect. Ben Shana Shaul b'malcho. The Gemara in Yuma Daf Chaf Beis says he was so perfect that when you're perfect, you can't even imagine that you made a mistake. Your only mistake is that you said, you know, I once thought I made a mistake, but I was wrong. I didn't. It's the only mistake I ever made. So that's Shaul. But David is, you know, is quick to say Chatasi. David is not the moral specimen that Shaul is. You know, in his inner mannerism, but that was Shaul's undoing. Yes.
Was it Hizkiyahu that was supposed to be the Moshiach, but then he didn't merit to be because he didn't sing Shirah? Because he said neighbor next door doesn't have like wood or something, so he's not singing.
That's Gemara at the end of Sanhedrin. But I'll tell you this. I mean, Hizkiyahu is a descendant of David, so he's in the right tribe. And when it says that he bikesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu lasos Sancheriv Gog u'Magog v'Chizkiyahu Mashiach, to make the Assyrian onslaught on Jerusalem to be like that final war that were of our salvation, and then let's get it over with, but Chizkiyahu didn't sing Shira. Now that Medrash is written 700, 800, 900 years after the events took place, and if I were to just try to give a pshat to the Medrash, it's saying that let us not make the same mistake. And that when we see salvation, and I often quote this Gemara right around the time of Yom HaTzma'ut, you know, that we should not be kafui tov and not recognize how different this is, and how different our time is as a result of being back in our land, etc. So, we will, by March and April, discuss whether we can justifiably say that the events in Israel the last 70, 80 years are harbingers of a messianic era. If you're a religious Zionist, I think you do say so. But what are the objections that others might have? I don't mean the Torah Karet and Satmar. I mean, you know, it was well known. Rabbi Norman Lamb wrote about this in the 1970s that he doesn't say bless the state of Israel, the first sproutings of our redemption. He says, bless the state of Israel, that it should become the first sprouting of them. Now, at what point can you say that it's become that? Ad infinitum, you just never say it? That's certainly at some point you can say it. Change it. You know, in 1953, I didn't think Israel was the first sproutings of our redemption. But in 2019, I think it is. You know, can you change that? We'll discuss all those positions. So we've gone through Reuven. We've gone through Yosef. Now, with Yosef, I would just tell you, I think, but this might we might have done the first week, the first time we met, is Yosef abuses the power. What he puts his brothers through is an abuse of power. That'd be far from me to say. When he tests them, and we know why he's testing them. He has to put them into the same situation so that they can repent properly. He's worried that their sin was so grievous, not just what they did to him. Maybe I deserved what you did to me, but what you did to our father. So Yosef has to teach them a lesson, but Yosef, aren't you quite aware yourself that you're putting your father through some grief as well for 9 years? Right? So maybe Yosef himself, why aren't they looking for me? He was waiting for them. He knew they would come. Right? All right, and plus, look, Ramban's, I just told you about Ravanel's approach. Ramban's approach is that Yosef really believed that everything that he had dreamed were prophecies that needed to come true to fulfill God's plan of how our nation is to start. And I need it all to come true. I need for them to bow down to me, all of them. Right? Okay, so it's interesting, but that's the and I think I've told you this before in another venue, is that the Haftorah of that story, on a very rare occasion, not happening for a number of years, when Chanukah doesn't coincide with that reading. It's always Chanukah when you read about Yosef putting his brothers through that. the very rare case where it's not Hanukkah, the Haftorah is where Shlomo suggests to a gasping room that in order to determine who the real mother is, he's going to cut a baby in half. Right? Have you heard the story about two families that spent, each one spent $10,000 to a shadchan to marry off their daughter to the same boy? And the woman took money from two different families and then disappeared. Hmm. Right? So each family said that we want, you know, he's the best boy in the yeshiva, we want him for our daughter. So they went to a din Torah, and the rabbi looked up at his Bava Metzia and his Shulchan Aruch, and he said, I don't know what to say. You two have exactly equal claims, so what we have to do is to cut the boy in half and give half for you, for your daughter, and give half to you for your daughter. And each one will have a half a boy. So the first mother said, that's crazy. I can't even be party to such a sick thing. I will not be part of this. You have to leave him whole. Let that woman have it for her daughter. So the second woman said, no. If it says, if the halacha is, you cut him in half, you cut him in half. So the rabbi looked at the second woman and said, give the boy the heart for her daughter. She's the true mother-in-law.
But why not say maybe both? Maybe undo the
tongue. Yeah, maybe. Maybe you can marry both of them. Yeah. Have a whole one for each one of them. So, Lamaisa, so when Shlomo puts a gasping room into the suspense of thinking that the unacceptable suspense of thinking that the king of Israel does indeed have the right to cut a baby in half for any purpose, that's an abuse of your kingship, and your kingdom will be cut in half for that.
You mean it's like so, slandering yourself?
Slandering the
concept of justice.
Yeah, I mean, remember when David claims to the crippled Mephibosheth, Shaul's grandson, that he split the field with the accuser. Remember that story? I'm not getting into the whole thing right now, but that when David says split the field, the heavenly voice comes out and says, it's so easy for you to just take someone's property like that because you're king? Mm-hmm. Now granted, David was the one who gave him the property in the first place, but you don't just, you know, you think things through a little more before you say that so impetuously. So David's decision to say Yachloku is similar to Shlomo. Oh, I have an idea how I can look good and be in this story and make it get into a Haftorah, and so, you know, it's sort of the same behavior. So what invalidated Yosef was this abuse of power. Okay. And when Yehuda, who gets the kingship, when he has a descendant who behaves in a similar way, it's not going to destroy your kingdom, but it'll split it. Okay? Now, along the way, I have an amazing dark horse. You know what a dark horse is, right?
No.
Yeah, someone who's like all the way in the back. Have no one ever thought that this one could possibly win? And in the end, you know, the odds are, you know, you could, if you put money on this one, yeah, you would have won, 200 to 1 on a, right? That dark horse is on page 128, 126, back to 126. Dun Yodin Amo,
he's the one that brings up the rear.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is, I mean, you know that the Yosef gets a nice big bracha, Yehuda gets a big bracha, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone else, not so much. Reuven and Shimon and Levi all get tzemaimist. You know, they're getting shmeist.
But Levi becomes...
Yes, because Moshe gives him a good bracha. But, right? Mm-hmm. But so Reuven, Shimon, Levi...
Shimon disappears.
Yes, Yehuda, Yachakim B'Yakov, Avitam B'Yisrael, correct. Yehuda and Yosef get nice big brachas. Everyone else is pretty much a line. Okay? Yisachar and Zvulun are treated together. Somewhat together. And Don gets this nice big bracha. Don Yodin Amok Echad Shiftei Yisrael. That should have been it. Then he goes on. Yechid Don Nachash Alei Derech Shifon Alei Orach Anoshech Yikvei Sus Ve'Porach Bo'achor. So it's about security, right? Remember, what you want from your king is to make the people in your nation feel secure. You can't do anything if you're going to running the bomb shelters.
Right? If it's not a monarchy, how exactly did the king get chosen?
later the Torah is going to say that it seems to be a contradiction in the Torah by saying, appoint a king that God shall choose for you, which means that through an oracle, right? Wait for the appointment to come, which is how our kings came. You know, Shaul was appointed by the prophet. David was appointed by the prophet. It's a very, very important message. Right after Shaul was appointed by Shmuel, he told him, we have a big battle to fight against the Philistines. Wait for me for 7 days, and then we're going to bring a sacrifice together, and then we'll fight the Philistines. And Shmuel, I think, purposely came late. He's late. The Philistines are just over the hill. The people are scattering. And Shaul decides, I'm going to bring the sacrifice myself. And then Shmuel shows up. I think Shmuel is like watching over you know, how long is he going to hold out? Mm-hmm. Right? And when, as soon as he starts offering the sacrifice, then Shmuel shows up. What did you do? He goes, well, I saw the people, they're running away. I see the Philistines over the hill. What am I supposed to do? I don't want to fight them and without bringing the sacrifice first. And I can't just sit here like a sitting duck and let them overrun us. What am I supposed to do? You're the one at fault by showing up late. And he tells him, sorry, you lost your kingdom over this. Such a minor slight.
It's an outrage.
But what it is what Shmuel is trying to teach them.
There's a separation between the Navi and the king.
They fight with kings and horses. We fight with prophets. Mm-hmm. And we don't. You win the battle alone. You can't. You know you can't defeat the Philistines. Mm-hmm. Only when the prophet comes and is part of that system. We don't want to start a monarchy with all of the negativity that all other monarchies have brought to the world. We don't want our monarchy to be a philosopher king like Socrates. I have no doubt, if you look at how the Torah presents what the king is supposed to do and read the Plato's Republic of what he thinks the king should be, it's the same person. He walks around with the Torah, he's promulgate justice, don't become too wealthy, don't have such a big harem, and Socrates creates the same philosopher king personality. And when Shaul starts to waver about who's the one really responsible for defeating the Philistines, I don't know if 1 in 100 would act any different. Because you see that, you know, they're here, what am I supposed to do? He's late, right? It was probably a test of some sort, right? So Shaul, you see that, you know, it's all about it starts about the protection. So when Dan, so you know that when he's talking about Dan is like a Nachash, the Nachash is the underdog. He has to bite the horse. The horse will stomp on his head and kill him, but I can also, you know, sneak in and take down the horse and his rider too, right? But you pull Ruch Bo Rachor, I could take out his chariot. Who's that? Shimshon. Right? We just came from there. We just passed by, near Beit Shemesh, there were all these places. The streets are named after events regarding Shimshon.
That was where they had the idol, right? Done.
That's later. That's much later. That's later. After Shimshon. Yeah. That's possibly, you know, look, when it says here, remember bringing this dark horse in, it's not because he mentions the horse here, but it's right after he blesses Don, it says, Lishuascha kivisi Hashem.
I didn't know it was there.
I, you know what we say when we create Shema Lamita. I await your salvation, O God. Why right there? Surely this should have been said after he finished blessing all of them. And say, God, I know I'm dying soon. I wait your salvation. Right? We say this every night before going to sleep. These 3 words, right, with all kinds of permutations. Right. So, what's going on? So the Medrash says that he did get a glimpse of Shimshon. And he thought that Shimshon had of all, you know, quickly shows him all the people, and he says, that man could be Mashiach. Don, one of the Shifchos, Don, Bilhah's son, Don, what has he done? Right? So, And plus, you know, before Shimshon, there's Moshe. There's lots of people between Yaakov and Shimshon that he could have seen who have the potential to be Moshiach. So I would say it's as follows. I can hardly think of anybody in Tanakh. And I don't think Moshe fits this, because Moshe, in Parshas Baaloscha, you know, when Yisrael complained to him about the meat, he loses it. He says, did I give birth to these people? Am I their mother? I should hold them like a mother holds them? If I was their mother, I'd find them food for them. But I'm not their mother. What do you expect from me? Right? Rashi says, in my opinion, it's because he said these words they didn't get into Israel. It's just that he said them just between him and God. But when he hit the rock, that was in public. But Shimshon is the opposite. Shimshon had to fight through every indignity of not being accepted by his people, of the rejection of constantly having to fight alone. But he never loses hope, never gives up the support of his people. They even hand him in. Remember, the people of Yehuda handed him in as a troublemaker. What are you problem? What is the problems you're giving with us, with the Philistines, our neighbors? When they wanted to hand him in, he said, listen, just promise me you're not going to kill me. You can tie me up and give me over to the Philistines. I'm fine with that. Right? So then when they gave him up, and the Philistines came, and that's where he took the jawbone and smashed. It's a great scene in the movie Samson and Delilah with Victor Mature. You ever see that scene? How they could visualize how he killed one day. You know, the guy had to report back to the kingdom of the Philistines. He goes, well, how many were there? And he goes, one. And he said, and how many men did you lose? Sire, we lost over 1,000. So, anyway, so he loses out because Mashiach not only has to be a good protector for the people, he has to be a moral, some moral, specimen. He had no control, self-control of himself. I mean, that's what the Gemara says, that why he had to be a Nazir, because at least, you know, your lack of self-control without the inhibition of sobriety is a real problem. You know that's hopefully when you're in charge, because you're not, you know, when you're drunk, we don't, the wine weakens the part of our brain that helps us make good decisions, you know.
So you didn't like any women from today as well?
Well, because it was a bigger accomplishment for him. Right? When you're rejected by everyone in your inner circle, you have to, you know, be accepted by everyone in the outer circle. So, yeah. Okay, so that's why Dan was out, right? And it's also just remember also that the Binyamin gets a shot. That I would think that if Shaul had waited for Shmuel, and had he not sinned with Amalek. I don't know. I don't think, because Yaakov says it's Yehuda lo yisushevet. The prophet does tell him, had you waited for me, your kingdom would have been established ad olam. Now, ad olam, I think there means for a good long time. Not in perpetuity, just like it says that a Hebrew slave wants to work, he gets his ear pierced and he works ad olam. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean forever, because no one lives forever.
Right.
Even though Hashem yimloch l'olam va'ed, or ad olam means forever in some places in the Tanakh. But since no one lives forever, it means he's a slave for a good long time, till the Yovel. Right? Mm-hmm. I think he would have built the Beis HaMikdash. Mm-hmm. He would have built the temple, and Shaul would have built the temple in his own land.
Yonatan would have gone after him.
Yonatan, yeah. So that's, remember when I told you that when Yaakov was fleeing from Esav and only one child didn't bow down? Mm-hmm. It's Binyamin. And God told him, listen, don't be afraid of any of this. These are tests indeed. And they're not saying that to experience it is an easy thing. But you will survive all these things, as will your descendants. Because as we stand here, let me assure you, kings will descend from you. Now, the Pasha Pshat is that could be from one of the children he already has. Mm-hmm. But you know, Chazal, Nuachim Mechalatzecha Yetzeyu. It's a Taisfus in the second parak in Sanhedrin that asks, what Mishagas got into Avner's head, that when Shaul was killed, he appointed Shaul's son, Ishbosheth, as king over all the tribes except Yehuda. It wasn't obvious to every single person in Shaul's kingdom, as well as everyone else in Israel, that David is already suited to become king. Mm-hmm. What Mishagas got in his head to appoint Ishbosheth? So unprepared and just unacceptable as a king. Right? So it could be a few things. One, I want to be loyal to my king. Plus Shaul and Avner are cousins, right? Mm-hmm. Avner's father Ner and Shaul's father Kish are brothers.
Shaul's continuity.
Right, okay. I'm loyal to my... Plus it's better for me, right, that the king should be my cousin's son than it should be someone from Shevet Yehuda. And three, says the Tosfos, is that when Yaakov said, "Melachim mechalatzecha yetzeyu," two kings are yet descended to come from you, so he only had one more son after this. So there has to be like an oracle, a famous oracle from ancient times, that two kings must descend from Binyamin. And that second king was manifest in Ishbosheth. Sorry to say, not Yonatan. It's very sad that leaders of Israel so far have had children problems. Mm-hmm. Everyone has someone off the derech. Everyone. Moshe doesn't even have a child that's on the derech, it seems. Mm-hmm. A grandson of his is the head of Navodah Zarah at the end of Sefer Shoftim. Gershom ben Moshe. Mm-hmm. Remember? At the end of Shoftim, it changes his name to Menashe with the hanging nun. Know what I'm talking about? Does it sound familiar? I'll just show you the picture of it. You can see what it looks like in the text. It's Shoftim, page 600 and... we'll have to look for it in a minute. If I had the Koran has it spelled out clearly. There's a hanging nun. It says Gershom ben Menashe, but without the hanging nun, it's Moshe. But you get the point. Finally, this one person, the first king of Israel, has such a perfect son. His son Yonasan, a tragic figure, but he's such a good guy. He's such a wonderful person all around.
Because he was close to David,
a king has, and then Shaul tells him, "Don't you realize that as long as that Ben Yishai is alive, you will never be the next king of Israel, and that he's responsible for you losing your kingdom." So if Yonasan was a mechutzav, he would have responded to his father, "Dad, David's not the reason why I'm not being the next king of Israel. You are." Okay. Finally, as a leader with a good enough son to carry on. None of the shoftim do. The only shofet who has a son here, it's page 632, the end of chapter 18. The only shofet who has a son who rules after him is Gideon, and boy, that didn't work well. Right? You know what I'm talking about? Ahimelech, page 632. Look at the very end of chapter 18. You'll see there's like the word Menashe with a hanging nun. See it there?
Oh, yeah. Right here.
Oh.
I've never seen it above like that. That's really strange.
See, the nun is not online with everything else.
Maybe the nun's for
Nechad. Okay, so that is that's Binyamin who does get the Beis Hamikdash built in his area, and Shaul probably would have done it from his tribe, right? But it was not meant to be. So now you got the different pictures. The others were never really in the running, but there's Reuven, there's Yosef, there is, this Yehuda, Binyamin, and even a chance for Dan. But it shows what we're looking for is Avas Yisrael, the security of Israel, freed from the shackles of the story of Mechiras Yosef. There's very little, but Yehuda. Yehuda is the one who gives the advice to save Yosef's life. He tries to get his one brother to take the other brother's wife and carry on the family name. Right? He admits to... The stories that about Yehuda at the end of Bereishis is really about someone who's profoundly flawed. He's not as perfect as Yosef, He's profoundly flawed, but he works at getting better. He fixes Bereshis. Yosef fixes Bereshis a little too with his two sons and with the, you know, the crossover. Mm-hmm. But that's what it's all about. Mashiach is supposed to fix us. Therefore, the one chosen to be the ancestor of Mashiach has to fix with, you know, some of the things that are broken.
And a good leader has to take advice from other people.
Too, for sure.
So some of the things that are perfect isn't going to take advice from other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. So we're on for December 18th is our next...